So, I'd like to talk a little bit about friendship and perhaps those qualities around friendship which we may all know or we have or can develop either with our own mind or with people or in relation to pleasure. And perhaps also what might arise from that. And I read out this poem because it's, for me, it's kind of very a source of inspiration. I was very intrigued by it and also uplifted when I first read it. And since then I kept reflecting on it. And there's something about this relationship between this man and the elephant, and eventually that the elephant stretches out its leg and the man is climbing up. So there seems to be some kind of trust which has led for the elephant to stretch out its leg, and perhaps also some kind of affection, support, understanding, familiarity perhaps even intimacy. So then they ride off together, not separately, but as a team, so to speak. And especially kind of the elephant representing something quite wild, doesn't need to be, but I remember when I was in Burma and I was going up to the jungle to meditate there, they told me there are wild elephants there. So I got a bit scared, but then eventually the elephants didn't see any of them up there. And supposedly the elephant is wild, but eventually it got so trusting to this man that he would actually come forward and be of support. So that's kind of a bit of a journey. How did that happen from being perhaps quite wild and then being so trusting and so kind, so friendly? Kind of some process and some way of how this good man has been relating to the elephant and how the elephant eventually develop trust. And then further down in this poem, obviously here the nun speaks about her own practice, sitting and walking and sitting and walking day after day, what we're doing here as well. And just by seeing that, something shifted in her perspective. And she took a seat under the next tree, sat down, and based on this incident, she then reached out a gentle hand to her own mind. So if I hold that as an idea, what is that looking like, reaching out a gentle hand to your own mind? And when we say mind here, it could also be heart or heart-mind, however you want to define it. Just kind, even if I think about it, there's even like a touch to it or a kind of a texture. Don't know how it's for you, but just kind of speaks that image. And it's almost like the same movement as the man moved towards the elephant in order to develop trust, is that movement for oneself towards one's mind with gentleness, reaching out. Yeah, how would that look like in practice? Perhaps we are already doing that, but just kind of taking that as an image. again remembering times in Burma when I was sitting in that bespoke jungle. And I had a very clear agenda what I wanted to do in that jungle and how I wanted to practice and how it should look like. The agenda was definitively attaining peace and calm, and it ideally also some deep insights, and gentleness didn't feature much in that moment when I was sitting there on the tree on a platform. It was more of a kind of hour after hour endurance and sitting through the night and eventually coming and facing, you know, my own limitations and also my own fears. But then eventually something could shift and gentleness was manifesting. But for some reason I had to first go through the hard kind of practice. And here the suggestion is like, well, we can actually perhaps start right from the beginning on how we are meeting our experience, how we are meeting our mind and its many manifestations. So here the last sentence, truly I thought this is why I came to the woods, to reach out a gentle hand to one's own mind. And if we reach out a gentle hand to our own mind, it may reveal something to us. Because there's trust, because there's familiarity, because there's kindness. And to develop friendship takes time and it takes cultivation. And then hanging out with each other, spending time, and over time one becomes more and more familiar with, knows. And then there's also the beauty of friendship, like qualities which are being cultivated within that relationship with a friend. And what is being received, one, and what one can give into this friendship. So it's not something which is manifesting out of nowhere. There's some kind of cultivation. And then what we receive from a friendship is also in a way inspiring us, or enriching us, or nourishing us. So there's kind of a two-way kind of relationship going on, gentleness and trust being a foundation for that. So how does that relate to your practice, to our time here and to our theme of pleasure? Perhaps I would phrase it towards cultivating what brings happiness, or cultivating what is beautiful. Something which is perhaps independent on what we met before and talked before of sense pleasures, but something which is kind of a deeper source of replenishment for ourselves and something we can discover. And it's coming down again to this relationship, whether it is to pleasure or whether it's to any other mind state arising in our heart. How do we meet that mind state? How do we meet our experience? Are we able to reach out a gentle hand, being aware, noticing it, but then perhaps that movement towards gentleness and acceptance. So the Buddha spoke about right intention. He spoke about many other things, but right intention in the sense of right thought, or when it's said right skillful intention, skillful thought, how we bring an attitude towards our experience. And because thoughts are so pervasive, it's kind of quite an important path factor on the Eightfold Noble Path, the second one, because the thoughts and how we meet things are quite powerful and have an impact on how we then move into the world and act. So what he suggests are kind of three ways how we can cultivate a relationship with our experience, or bringing a wholesome intention, skillful intention. One is renunciation, or perhaps we can rephrase it and understanding like the mind of letting go. And then another one is loving kindness, metta, the opposite from ill will. And the third is compassion, the opposite of cruelty. And we can understand them in a way, or cultivate them on two levels. One on a kind of more, on a level which I just touched on in terms of relationship to our experience, but also cultivating those qualities by themselves, as we have also done over the past few days, kind of with the Brahma Vihara practice. And also kind of in our daily life, in how we relate to things and how we can actually use our relationship to things or situations as a support for skillful mind states, or even the arising for pleasure and pleasurable mind states. So starting perhaps with renunciation, which may not appeal too much for many of us, because it comes with certain ideas, like of restraint, or perhaps of losing something, not something which is very appealing. And the question is, how we can understand renunciation, for example, in this retreat. You have come here and you left your kind of worldly outer things behind, and any kind of relationships or perhaps communication, and made quite an effort to come here. And then being here, kind of the usual pleasures or the usual things have fallen away, and perhaps there is a possibility of a certain lightness or a certain simplifying of one's being here in this retreat container, being cared for, looked after. So there has been something given up, and at the same time something is being received, which might be pleasant for some of us. For others, in other moments, it might be more difficult. But there is some joy which may eventually come from letting go and simplification, simply by changing some of our habits or not doing the familiar and coming into a space where we can be in a different way. I remember myself when I decided to ordain as a nun, my best friend who knew me since the age of 3, her first reaction was when I said, I'm going to Myanmar and become a nun. She said, but then you can't go to the cinema anymore. And not to the theater. And it was a real concern for her. And I really had to think for a moment, yes, that's true, I can't go to the, or I'm, at least I may not go to the cinema anymore. But it didn't really feel an obstacle, obviously, otherwise I wouldn't have taken the decision. But there was kind of some inner, actually, there's something which I value more, or found a certain pleasure, which has a different quality than going to the cinema. And I'm saying that not in terms of devaluating going to the cinema, but for someone who has been quite in the arts like myself, it was quite substantial. And yet, something else has manifested which felt more valuable. It didn't feel as something I had to restrain, didn't feel like I had to give up something. It was a natural, gradual letting go and finding delight or purpose in something different. So I don't know how it is for you with the kind of letting go of things, but for me, the journey has been very much like a gradual process. It would not work if I would tell myself, you have to restrain yourself from those or these things. And the mind tends to actually then react perhaps even the opposite way. In a way, coming back to that image of the elephant and the man, how can a relationship being developed which is actually fruitful, not by force, not by kind of wanting it to push through, but actually by a gradual letting go because of trust or because of finding some other pleasure in it. And there's something else interesting, and I'm having yet, it's still an inquiry going on for me, is the relationship also between renunciation and generosity. So there's something about giving up, and at the same time there's some giving and receiving. And at first it looks like, yes, there are two different qualities in the virtues known as the paramis in the Theravada tradition. They are actually separate, nekama for renunciation and dana for generosity. But interesting, in the Tibetan tradition, there is just dana. Nekama doesn't appear, but generosity. But the understanding, at least of some teachers, is it's the mind of giving and letting go. So when we offer or give something to someone else, we may also let go of something at the same time. Sounds indicative, but there is some relationship, and I'm still inquiring into that. Giving up and giving at the same time. And receiving by giving up something different. So renunciation in the understanding not of losing something, but actually of receiving something. And for example, coming here, you're giving up certain things, but you're also giving yourself to the practice and actually to yourself in showing up and also with some of the difficulties coming up. So there is something about you're giving up in order to give. You give yourself and you also give all of us the support of being here. So it's quite an interesting dynamic, and I haven't yet come up with a theory on it, but there's some relationship and also some possibility of joy arising because of that movement of giving. And the way we can also practice renunciation or giving up are also these kind of small little habits. We can experiment with them or play, not in a way of reducing ourselves, but just seeing what happens if we change certain routines which we felt belong to us or support us. And actually when we change them or we do something different, we might find that something else opens up. So sometimes the experience is not of losing, but of gaining something else. So just for example, most of us eat with the right hand. I do. Perhaps you eat with the left hand, not sure. And I was with my mother last year, and she couldn't move her right arm anymore properly. So I suggested, why not eat with the left arm? And she said, it's not possible. Of course, it is possible, but it was just kind of the habit pattern of the mind didn't want that, and because of that it felt at first kind of uncomfortable, or almost like I'm giving up some part of me which is being used. There's something about habit pattern which seem to give us comfort, but actually they may keep us also a little bit limited. So in that moment she couldn't properly eat her soup until I invited her again, why not try the left arm? And so at first it was a bit tricky, a bit difficult, but then eventually she could eat with the left arm, left hand. And to support her, I then also started to eat with my left hand. And again, it was so interesting to see what seemed to be not possible suddenly becomes possible. Just kind of trying it out, and of course it takes more effort doing it with the left hand, but eventually staying there, trying, and at some point it's like it doesn't matter which hand, but it's just interesting to see again how we are eventually attached to certain way of doing things which are limiting, and when we play with it something else opens up, even joy, even pleasure. Try out, for example, brushing your teeth with the other hand. And it's just kind of allowing more possibilities of what we think is possible and what we are attached to and what we think makes us and me in a certain way. This is the way I do things and that is me. If we do things in a different way, is there less of me, or perhaps a different me. There's one aspect of renunciation which I put in here, which I find also inspiring, suggested by one of my teachers, which he would call holy disobedience. And this is basically relating to the practice of the wisdom of saying no, and directly related again to how we may relate to certain urges or to certain tendencies in the mind which want to proliferate, especially thoughts. I think we're all familiar with that. One side triggers a certain feeling triggers a certain thought, and then off we go on a train and we are in a whole jungle and a whole world opens up. And sometimes it can be skillful to not go down that track, but to actually apply what she calls holy disobedience. So we are saying no firmly, but coming from a place of wisdom rather than from a place of rejection and aversion. So especially if we're caught up in thought fabrications around certain mind states or emotions we have, that's perhaps sometimes the time when we see it repeatedly where we have the choice to say, no, I will be disobedient in a holy way because it's for a wholesome purpose or whatever works for you. But I found it quite powerful in my own practice to apply sometimes as another way of renunciation, of letting go by saying no. And whether that's in our practice, in the formal practice as we're working with our minds, or whether that's in our daily life. Again, certain pleasures or happy patterns are not supportive, skillful for our well-being, and are not supportive for pleasurable or wholesome states. So again, it's not about restraining, but to apply the wisdom. What is actually helping me? What is supporting my well-being and the well-being of others? The Burmese master, who we both know, Laura and myself, Sayadaw Wuthichaniya, he would suggest when you go through the day with your practice, basically watching your mind 24 hours, unless you sleep, asking questions like, is this necessary? Or is this helpful? Or is it not helpful? And then we can eventually practice the letting go, just kind of listening. Is it true? Is it really necessary? No, I don't need this, might be the answer. Or perhaps, I don't need to carry on with this particular thought. So we have a choice, firmly, but without aversion in it. So, just a few words on metta more specifically, because in a way we already touched on that spirit of metta in the retreat, and also what I shared about this quality of friendship and relationship. The way metta most resonates with me is, I'd call it the art of unconditional acceptance. One pointing towards that quality which does not expect anything, the unconditional quality of metta, which does not wish for something in return, which sticks out for me as a feature of metta. It's that quality which gives something or someone complete space without putting any restrictions, boundaries, or expectations to it. And the other aspect is, I call it the art of unconditional acceptance, because it is an art in the way that it requires cultivation. Even if we can assume that that quality of friendliness and acceptance and benevolence may already be with us, there is something which needs some intention and some cultivation in order for it to grow and to manifest. And there is an art to it, because it's not just by doing it. Again, I remember my own practice with metta when I started formally, repeating again phrases or repeating again any visualizations, just kind of doing it. I was missing that touch of art. It's kind of knowing when and how at any given time. And sometimes the metta might be just an inner smile, or it may be just the image of a sun shining towards a difficult feeling or a difficult person, and it may not need a phrase or a visualization or a formal practice. It's just kind of tuning into that shift of perspective, looking with kind eyes or looking with warmth. And only over years kind of I discovered, oh, this is really an art. It takes some skill and it takes some dedication. And the more we do it, the easier it comes, which is very beautiful. So metta is not just a good idea and we think we have enough of it. We actively need to cultivate it. And specifically in relation to our more difficult mind states, those who are challenging us, because metta is directly an antidote to fear and also aversion. So when there's metta, in that moment, there cannot be directly aversion. Maybe there for a moment. So in the Abhidharma, they speak about different mind moments. So from that perspective, when there is a mind moment of metta, there can't be a mind moment of aversion. But in our experience, we may just experience aversion continuously, and then what's our way of looking and holding that aversion without adding fuel? And that's this attitude of unconditional acceptance. So I'm not asking the aversion to go away, I just accept it, but I don't invest in it, and the aversion is not me and myself. So it's that fine balance, it's that attitude with which I can hold aversion or a difficult mind state. And then also not being discouraged when we fall back into our kind of patterns and tendencies of irritation and annoyance. It's just kind of bringing awareness to it. And then how can I bring this quality of metta informally to my own anger, to my own aversion, to my fear, by accepting it, not expecting it to be any different or go away. And coming back to the image with the elephant, what made it possible that the elephant developed the trust with that good man stretching out the leg? Because that good man has given space, has given time, has given dedication. Thich Nhat Hanh, he suggests in a way to work with anger, to holding it in your arms with great tenderness. So he's kind of practicing or suggesting for practice bringing mindfulness to anger, like the sun shining on a flower, which I also sometimes work with, just kind of imagining the sun is shining on a difficult mind state, or when I'm caught up with contraction, even just that image can gently shift the way I'm relating to it, or even loosen up some contraction I may experience in my body. Because when we are in an aversive state, the body contracts, the midline somewhere here tends to contract. And so sometimes it's just like you're aware of the anger, and there's the possibility of just sending a little smile there, and already that could shift it just giving it space and gentleness and acceptance. And then a few words on compassion, leading on from metta compassion. And we can say they are very closely interrelated. Sometimes they are kind of presented in connected ways or practiced together. But whereas metta is this wish for well-being and happiness and this unconditional acceptance, compassion, we can say, is when metta meets the suffering, when this benevolence or this goodwill is meeting the suffering and the impulse arises wanting that suffering or that being or that state to be free from suffering. So there is kind of a different nuance to it. So I'd call it the art of turning towards. And it comes with like a certain level of our willingness. So it's not necessarily that we have to do something, but it's our willingness to meet the difficult and to meet the suffering, rather than the impulse of turning away. So perhaps you may have experienced when we see difficult situations, people suffering, or hearing some news, or just kind of with all what is going on, what is our reaction? And again, just noticing what are the impulses going on, tendency perhaps to turn away or to deny or to be overwhelmed, or perhaps wanting to go straight into action and change it. And each of them is kind of actually a bit of an avoidance to actually meet the suffering as it is. And not even straight want to jump in and change it, just to meet it, that willingness. So again, coming to our practice and our inner work, when there is a difficulty, when there is suffering, in addition to unconditional acceptance, can we meet the suffering in it, see it as suffering, and then bring that wish to ourselves or that mental state to be free from suffering in the same way then we would bring compassion to a person or to ourselves? Can we bring that to our own suffering? And in a way, compassion starts with ourselves. If we understand the difficulty and the suffering and how we can meet it in ourselves, we develop the capacity also to develop it with other people and in our surrounding. But it has to start with our own experience. The quality of metta has something around opening. There's kind of an opening towards the difficult. And that requires also a certain steadiness and perhaps a certain courage, which we also are developing in that moment. And so often our reaction is when we have a situation either with ourselves or with other people which is quite difficult, not really seeing how the other person is actually caught up in their own suffering. And we may not really understand it because we haven't really understood it in ourselves. So sometimes somebody lashing out and being quite difficult with us as a result of their own being caught up. The example, for example, of a animal being trapped in a trap and is very aggressive. We can't see the trap, we only see the aggressiveness of the animal and actually even might become frightened. But if we walk around the bush, we see that one of the legs of the animal is being caught. So how many times are we caught? And understanding that so I think I'd like to finish with another poem, because I love poems. But perhaps in the spirit of coming back to this aspect of friendship and the qualities we're developing in that relationship, of letting go, of unconditional acceptance, of turning towards. And the friends which can help us in that process and in our practice. Qualities of the mind we can experience, cultivate, and actually we are practicing in this retreat. And you may remember or recognize one of them or several of them. So this is another poem inspired by the early Buddhist nuns, by Matti Weingast, called Jenta, Conqueror. I was forever getting lost until one day the Buddha told me, to walk this path you will need 7 friends. Mindfulness, curiosity, courage, joy, calm, stillness, and perspective. For many years, these friends and I have traveled together, sometimes wandering in circles, sometimes taking the long way around. There were days when I thought I couldn't go on. There were days when I thought I was finally beaten. It's scary to give all yourself to just one thing. What if you don't make it? Oh my heart, you don't have to go it alone. Train yourself to train just a little more gently. So just let's sit for a few minutes.